You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Since the mid-1990s, between 5,000 and 9,000 people who identify as Native American have been disenrolled from 79 tribes across 20 states. The issue of tribal disenrollment is highly controversial, and the Nooksack Tribe of Washington State is currently facing legal resistance from hundreds of its removed members. Joining us now is Brooke Jarvis, whose article, The Disenrolled, is about the current battle over what it means to identify as tribal in America. It was published in the January 22nd issue of the New York Times Magazine. It's also available online as Who Decides Who Counts as Native American. And I'm very pleased to welcome Brooke to our show. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You begin by stating that the Nooksack Native American tribe, which has about 2,000 members, is federally recognized. What does that mean for a tribe to be federally recognized? Do its members get certain rights as a result?
They do, yeah. So federal recognition implies that you have you're a sovereign tribe, you have a nation-to-nation relationship with the U.S. government, and you have treaty rights based on, you know, previously negotiated treaties dating back often many hundreds of years. And to become federally recognized, there are a lot of requirements, one of which is that you have to have maintained historical continuity, which for many tribes was difficult because you had to maintain it at the same time that the federal government was really actively trying to destabilize tribal communities in a lot of different ways.
So you had to have remained in contact with the reservation if there was a reservation, for example. But as you point out, in many cases, people were encouraged to go to the cities and assimilate themselves there.
Right. I mean, there were all kinds of mechanisms. There were boarding schools that children were forced to go to, separated from their parents. The creation of reservations is one example that often could actually divide tribes, and also reinforced sort of artificial divisions that weren't part of the way that tribes traditionally thought of themselves. The Nooksack tribe, for example, when they signed the Treaty of Point Elliott in the 1850s, which Northwest tribes signed, and it involved giving up a lot of their land in exchange for the ability to keep their hunting and fishing and gathering rights, the Nooksack didn't receive a reservation. Instead, they were told to go live with another tribe on the coast when they were based more in the mountains. And that was, you know, just one of the things that happened to kind of disrupt historical continuity in their case.
What about the right to share in the proceeds of a casino, as we've seen with many tribes?
Yeah, so a lot of tribes have casinos, and many of them will give per capita distributions of the proceeds of the casinos to their members, and you have to be a member to receive that. So a lot of the disenrollments that we've seen have been in tribes with casinos, particularly small tribes with casinos. And for a long time, I think the story of disenrollment was told as being specifically and only about casinos and about struggles over who was going to get that per capita. But when I started looking into the story, I discovered that you know, there were a lot more things at play. That's certainly one of the factors, but it's not the only one. I was really interested to learn how much the history of U.S. relationships with tribes made enrollment questions just deeply complicated.
Aren't there 566 federally recognized tribal nations? How does the government currently define Native American? I hear there are currently about 33 different definitions.
In a lot of different ways. That number 33 definitions comes from a study that someone did in the late 1970s. And there, you know, that was just federal definitions at that time. There are also state definitions. And of course, each tribe is empowered to use its own requirements to determine its membership. But those requirements are often very shaped by the way that the federal government looked at things, often including in the 19th century when we had, to be frank, you know, a more racist way of looking at things.
So how do they generally define it? How many of your ancestors were Native Americans?
So the majority of tribes in the lower 48, about two-thirds of them, use blood quantum, which is, it means the percentage of Indian blood. And a lot of this sounds sounds very strange to those of us who don't have experience in Indian country and the way that things work there. You know, it sounds unusual, but people who deal with it on a day-to-day basis are very used to it. So anyway, 2/3 of tribes use blood quantum, and the most common requirement is that you have to have 1/4 degree of Indian blood. And the simplest way you could get that is by having 1 grandparent, but there are a lot of other ways you can arrive at it. And so we've had courts weighing in on, you know, I don't know off the top of my head, but like 129 out of 230 as a fraction of Indian blood, and whether that counts as significant. Often these debates become very detailed and technical. There's a researcher who spoke to people about how they felt about being defined in this way. And they gave her some really interesting answers. One woman said, I don't like to be talked about in a vocabulary that's usually reserved for dogs and horses. And another man said, well, I'm also part white, but I don't have the papers to prove it. Commenting on, you know, the fact that this is sometimes a bit of an absurd feeling requirement. But there are also lots of people who really embrace those requirements, and they think that it brings clarity to complicated situations, and it keeps out people who, you know, maybe are have fraudulent claims or weren't raised in the culture. So they feel that it is a way to create at least some kind of boundaries and create clarity.
But when the government started to compile base rolls, they had to come up with all sorts of definitions, and they didn't have DNA testing or some of the other things we have today. You mentioned blood quantum was one of the rules, the basis, but also anthropologists used feet and hair width as a scientific test of blood degree in indigenous tribes. And since then, haven't courts even looked at how much an individual Native American eats fast food or if he or she drives a car?
That was one particularly famous case in Canada that was later overruled. The one you're mentioning that basically looked at whether a certain tribe had lost its authenticity because it had established, you know, embraced modern practices. So it was overruled because it was a pretty ridiculous ruling. But yeah, I mean, it's always been a kind of a confused situation. You know, you have these early government agents who were supposed to say, you have such and such percentage of Indian blood, but they had no way to test that. So they would ask, or they would just make their best guess by looking at people. You know, at this time when, as you mentioned, anthropologists felt that you could measure feet and that would give you an answer. And also there were some people who were very distrustful of the government taking these roles for understandable reasons, and many of them simply refused to be registered, and that has had implications for their ancestors ever since. So there are a lot of people who, for all kinds of reasons, don't fit into, you know, the neat boxes that we try to fit people in today.
Wouldn't DNA reveal one's ancestry?
It has been done in disenrollment cases. There was in some cases people have even been exhumed to test their DNA, but you know there are issues with that approach as well, and some people find that it's quite disrespectful.
Aren't Native Americans still issued cards by the federal government that state their degree of Native blood? How does that work? Have you seen any of those cards?
I have, yeah. And, you know, I'm not sure that everyone, I don't know quite the details of how those are given out, but it's called Certificate of Degree of Indian Blood. And again, if this isn't a debate that you're used to, that might seem bizarre. Like, we don't give certificates like that to people of other ethnicities in this country, and it would seem very strange if we did.
And when would you have to show that ID?
It's more like for... So there are lots of different ways in which you might, or times in which you might need to prove your membership or your Native Americanness. And so the most respected version is just if you are an enrolled member of a federally recognized tribe. That's the most accepted requirement, but it's not always. So you might be applying for benefits from the federal government for other reasons. You might, something that happens is if you commit a crime, the courts have to determine whether you should be treated as a tribal member who is under federal jurisdiction versus under state jurisdiction. So it's not cut and dry even in the life of an individual when they might be counted as Native American and when they might not.
Well, it's interesting to think about this purity aspect of the blood, because people who were deemed half-bloods or less were regarded as more responsible and given more freedom to handle their land in the past. That would just promote the dilution of the blood.
Right. Historically, there were a lot of times when the federal government was very purposeful about using these questions to divide Native communities or to take their land, which was a stated goal. Franklin Roosevelt at one point referred to the General Allotment Act as a great pulverizing force to break up the tribal mass. Mm. And that's something that they use the law to do quite a bit. So blood quantum, part of why it expanded so much was the idea that over time, as Native Americans intermarry, and they intermarry more than any other ethnic group in America, that they would dilute their legal standing in such a way that the government would no longer have the same responsibilities towards them. And that's just one example of a lot of ways where the government used the laws of identity to try to undermine tribal land claims and cohesion.
I'm speaking with Brooke Jarvis, whose New York Times Magazine feature, The Disenrolled, was published in January, the January 22nd issue of the New York Times Magazine. It's also available online under the heading Who Decides Who Counts as Native American. You spent time with a number of disenrolled Nooksacks. One was a man named Saint Germain. What's his story? And how did the tribe determine that he doesn't qualify as a member?
Well, in this case, there were actually two brothers with the last name Saint Germain, Rudy and Terry. And this the family in question that has been disenrolled from the tribe joined in beginning in the 1980s, and many of their descendants joined over time. And these two were among that group. Rudy was the secretary of the tribal council. And there had been questions over the years about whether this family should have been accepted in the first place. But it all came to a head in late 2012, I believe, when Terry made an effort to enroll his children in the tribe and was told that they would not be accepted. And it really spiraled from there. Rudy, therefore, was also not considered acceptable. The whole family, there were questions about whether the ancestor that they claimed when they applied for membership was truly their ancestor. And Rudy was eventually kicked off the tribal council, and things just got a lot more complicated and a lot more contentious from there.
And so he and other people have formed a group called the Nooksack 306. These are people who have been thrown out of the tribe. Aren't they suing the tribe? Under what grounds?
There are a number of lawsuits going on. So the 306 have been fighting their disenrollment for more than 4 years now. And so there have been lawsuits to fight the disenrollment. There have been, at one point, the tribe refused to hold elections that were scheduled because they had tried to disenfranchise the 306 and the judge stopped them. So elections have not been held, and that is a big source of the continuing legal wrangling.
And how have the courts leaned in the past when it comes to tribal identification? Can a tribe be sued for discrimination? There was a Supreme Court decision, Santa Clara Pueblo versus Martinez.
Right, and that's a case that is pointed to quite a bit. So in that case, a woman brought a suit under the Native American Civil Rights Act, Indian Civil Rights Act, saying that she was being discriminated against because her child was not admissible into the tribe because the tribe used paternal instead of maternal descent as its criteria. And in that case, the court decided that tribes had a right as sovereign entities to make up those membership requirements themselves, even if it did seem to be a form of, in that case, sexual discrimination.
How has forced disenrollment had an impact on the Nooksack community? Did former members have to leave their homes and jobs if they were tied to employment within the community?
Many people have been fired, and there's ongoing the question of homes is ongoing. At least one person has been evicted, and they're fighting that legally now. And it's also been a big personal impact. Many people told me they couldn't really imagine how people would get over this in the future, like how they would come back to being community. And it's very divided. The people that I talked to were extremely angry at the other side, on both sides.
Is this situation unique to the Nooksack? Are we seeing this in tribes across the country?
Yeah, across the country. The Nooksack situation stands out because it's so unusually contentious, and it has led to, you know, elections being canceled and people being recalled from office for treason, and the lawyer being banned from the reservation, and the judge being fired, and now these ongoing federal lawsuits. And so that is unusual, but disenrollment itself is becoming less and less unusual.
And now there are even membership consultants, a whole new industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When I was starting to write this article, I had a hard time deciding which tribe I should write about because there were a lot of interesting cases that you could have dug into. Another that I seriously considered was the case of the Grand Ronde in Oregon, because that really illustrates the impact of history on these modern debates, because there, I believe it was 86 people were disenrolled because their ancestor was never officially, he wasn't on the base roll that tribe uses, even though he was a chief who signed the treaty that created their reservation. And the reason he wasn't on the base roll is that he was hanged by a lieutenant in the U.S. Army 2 years before it was created.
How has the federal government responded to this issue? Didn't the Department of Housing and Urban Development and Health and Human Services refuse to acknowledge disenrollment in order to continue providing aid for housing and health care?
It's a little bit more complicated than that. So the BIA has said that it's not going to weigh in on internal membership decisions. And I think that's the government, you know, realizing that that's not its role and stepping back. You know, allowing tribes to engage to be sovereign nations, which is what they are. So as those departments and the BIA have intervened in this case, they're very careful to say that they're not weighing in on who should or should not be a member of the tribe. They're reacting to the fact that what they consider valid elections have not been held, and therefore the governing body of the tribe doesn't have a quorum.
Has legislation been proposed either on a federal or state level to resolve some of these issues? And would they even apply because the Native Americans could claim that their reservations, if reservations involved, are sovereign states?
It would be very difficult to do and very contentious to do. Tribes, for good reason, are very concerned about safeguarding their sovereignty. And I've talked to some people who, you know, their biggest concern about disenrollment is that if there are egregious or what appear to be egregious instances of it, that the Supreme Court or some other federal entity would intervene in a way that could be disastrous for sovereignty. So that's, for many people, the biggest concern of what's happening here.
Are you following the lawsuits?
Yes. I think they'll be playing out for quite a while now.
Brooke Jarvis is a journalist and author of the New York Times Magazine feature, The Disenrolled. You can find it online as Who Decides Who Counts as Native American. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.